This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello everyone, this is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the people speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our site at www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. That's www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. Something new, you can also listen to us live via satellite on your Nokia phones. Just go to the website for details. We're honored to have with us this evening, Peter Idishogi. Peter is running for Congress in the 2nd Congressional District of Minnesota, a first-generation American born in London, England, and whose passion for people and government began as a child. Hello, Peter, and welcome to the People Speak Radio Show.
Hello, and thank you so much for inviting me to the show. And I'm very elated, and I thank you so for the opportunity to speak to a wide audience. And I hope that this goes well for both of us.
I'm sure it will. I have no doubts. I've been reading a lot about you, Peter, and I'm very impressed. Lovely accent. You were born in London. Can you tell us a little bit about when you came to this country?
I came here about 24 years ago, and I actually came to college here and ended up staying after I had lost my father, who was a diplomat in the United Nations, working for one of the specialized agencies, Food Agriculture Organization and the World Health Organization. And my mother had passed, unfortunately, at an early age, too. So I had lived abroad most of my life, and I decided to make the United States my home. So I started to work here and ended up getting a green card and becoming a U.S. citizen subsequently after that. And got my first foray into politics by working as an activist for a social justice organization called the Clean Water Action Group. And they have offices in different parts of the United States. And I learned about legislation, environmental legislation that impacted people directly, like Groundwater Protection, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, the Superfund sites. And I even came to California in the 90s to work on the Big Green, which was sponsored by Tom Hayden. And that did not pass, but I was part of the group that was mobilizing people and encouraging them to pursue a green agenda. And we can see now, over a decade now, how that must have been a wise decision, because not just because of global warming, but the industry of the future is going to be environmental technology. Indications have been made that we could create a trillion-dollar economy just by embarking on a massive works project to clean up environment as well as develop new products that could be used to promote a healthy green environment for the whole world. So that's how I began my career. And then I ran for office in 2004 for Congress. And prior to that, I was active in the political party that I belonged to, which was the Democratic Party. I was a member of the DNC, Democratic National Council, because I had given some money. And when you give a certain amount of money, I guess you get incorporated into it. And I've been involved in different elections at the local level here in Minnesota for different members of the state legislature, some of whom are still in office right now. And I got involved in their campaign through the grassroots group that I belong to, Clean Water Action Voter Education Project. And anybody that was strong on the environment, they endorsed, that was running for office. And once we endorsed them, then we were, as members of the organization, were trained to help do voter outreach on their behalf. And so when I ran for Congress in 2004, I was running with a progressive agenda in my heart to apply every legislative decision that is made in the corridors of power to the lives of people. And that has always been the hallmark of my campaign. People are everything.
Well, you know, Peter, that's just an absolutely wonderful presentation, and it's, and you know, exact. You know, people even here in our virtual auditorium are saying, "Well, you know, it sounds good." You're proposing the creation of a new economy that promotes the alignment of business and stewardship with the environment. The greenness of this idea is wonderful, but how exactly do you propose to do this?
Well, here's the situation. Over the last four decades, or so that's over the last 100 years, the industrialized world came. We went into the information world, and both Western Europe and the United States and now the Asian tiger states, and that is South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and including China and Malaysia, have emerged. And many of them have emerged using methods that have unfortunately led to greater emissions of hydrocarbons into the environment. And we see that the Chinese and the Indians are about one of the fastest growing economies in the world, unquestionable in the next two decades. China will be the economic power of the world. And if they continue on the path that America and Western Europe followed to become where they are today, I'm not sure that we will see the world as it is today. The pollution will be staggering, and ice caps will melt, and things will get very serious. And so we need to come up with new products that can be introduced into these economies in such a way that will help clean the environment but also create jobs for the 21st century economy. And all I'm asking is to propose legislation that moves the subsidies that we're currently giving to oil industries and give it to people who are willing to become entrepreneurs in emerging environmental technology. That is one way we can do that. Secondly,
so
we can disincentivize.
You're actually suggesting that we use the economic mobility that we have at our control instead of for something that is actually good for the environment, as opposed to being bad for the environment.
Correct. You know, we have become dependent on a depleting industry and a depleting resource, which is oil. We have gone to war twice because of it, and so my suggestion is that you look at the amount of money we spent on the wars and the amount of resources that we used to fund the war, and we look at the amount of subsidies we're currently giving to the oil industry, which they do not need. They had the biggest profit that they've ever had in the last 8 years. No one can match them, unquestionably. Every quarter, the numbers come out for the major oil corporations, and it's high. And I'm not criticizing them for that. I'm saying that it's okay. They are a free market economy. They have a right to make money and turn a profit. They have to answer to a board of directors and shareholders. I understand. But they don't need their government subsidies when they have that much money. Give it to someone else that can use it, that will promote good stewardship of the environment, align new emerging businesses with the environment, that creates jobs for the future, that makes laid-off workers, some of them who have no jobs because their industry has been moved abroad, to create a new market economy for them. And this is where I'm coming from. The future for America to recover as the manufacturing giant of the world, a position we held in the 70s, can only come about when we build a new industry. And I believe that if we invest in the environment and with new emerging technologies and we unleash the entrepreneurial mind of the American people and encourage it, we're the most innovative country in the world. We can create a trillion-dollar economy, and we can put almost 5 million new jobs just from the environment alone. It can be done. We are the nation that put a man on the moon, and therefore, unquestionable, there's nothing that we cannot accomplish.
Well, that's amazing. You know, let me ask you, the claim here, and I find that to be, and I have read it, and I think that it is absolutely an interesting plan for sure. You claim to have the solution to the Iraqi dilemma that we happen to find ourselves in. I found that quite intriguing when I read that. And I would like you to, and I have to tell you, it's a bold initiative. It deals with the ongoing crisis in the country that we actually very kindly bombed into the next dimension. So I was I was hoping that you would elaborate a little bit on this Iraqi solution.
Well, I thank you very much for asking the question, and I appreciate it. The Iraqi solution was in my heart for over a year. I tried to get it out to the appropriate authorities at the highest level, at the height of when the Democrats had taken over Congress, and Nancy Pelosi had become the most powerful woman in the country, Nancy Pelosi, who is the Speaker of the House. And there was a big demand that we unilaterally withdraw our troops, and of course the opposition did not want the troops withdrawn, and I saw how divisive this issue was. And the goal of my campaign as I run for Congress is to deal with the most divisive issues of our country and resolve them. And as I began to receive this solution in my heart, I began to recognize that it was nonpartisan. It did not advance the agenda of any political party. It was the most realistic and innovative solution ever introduced to Iraq. It dealt with the core of the problem, which is to bring about reconciliation among the warring factions. And the Iraqi solution is predicated on, again, on people. It's a people-driven agenda, but this time it's the Iraqi people. The solution is in the www.iraqisolution.com. You can get it on YouTube. And it has an animated video while I speak about it. However, I will, to people who are listening to me on the radio, I will elaborate a little bit about it. The way for Iraq, considering that our country is divided, others believe that we must withdraw unilaterally. The others say that we must be there for, as one presidential candidate said, maybe 100 years. I believe the best way to resolve this conflict is to have a plebiscite, indeed a referendum, in Iraq, in which the Iraqi people get to decide whether the United States should stay and complete the mission and bring about peace and reconciliation, or whether we should pack up and leave. When we do this...
You know what? I don't want to... I want to interrupt for just one moment, because I want this to be very clear as to the message. Your statement exactly from your website is, we must be as careful leaving Iraq as we were as careless as going into Iraq.
Very correct. Very correct. Right now, the American people, the polls show 70% of them are tired of the war or want us out of there. It has affected the popularity of the president. And Republicans and Democrats together believe that this war is bleeding the nation and is costing us a lot of money. Almost over half a trillion dollars in the last 5 years. About $144 billion a year. $12 million, I believe, every hour. It's a serious problem. And we have to resolve this problem. We did not ask the Iraqis when we invaded them, but they get to decide their future direction of their country. And the best way to do that is to give them that opportunity. If they vote for us to go, we leave with dignity, we leave with honor, and we leave with a sense of pride. Democracy has spoken. Al-Qaeda did not send us out. Muqtada al-Sadr, the militant Shiite cleric, did not send us out. Foreign insurgents did not send us out. Elements from Iran and Syria did not send us out. We live because the people of Iraq have asked us to live. Every time you have an election in Iraq, you validate democracy. We do not find the weapons of mass destruction, but when elections are held there, we remind the world that we've managed to bring in a pluralistic form of government that was unheard of in that particular region. Equally important, the Iraqis for the first time get to decide the future. General David Petraeus, the brilliant military commander in charge of Iraq right now in terms of the military forces down there, will, for the first time, will have a strong hand. His hand will be strengthened in trying to bring about reconciliation among the warring factions. Right now, each one of them is negotiating individually with the U.S. military authorities, but they're not willing to negotiate sincerely and candidly with each other. When they realize that an election is going to be held in their country, it will be the most powerful signal we can send to the Iraqi people that we have no vested interest or ulterior motives, and that we're determined to make sure that they have a greater say in the future direction of their country. It will bring about negotiations among the warring factions, because none of them will be able to predict what will be their spheres of influence or their power structure should the American forces withdraw completely from Iraq. Right now, they are looking at the elections, the presidential elections. They know that there's a division in the country. The flag bearer of the Republican Party, John McCain, believes that we need to stay there as long as we could. He uses things like, we're not going to surrender, we must complete the mission. The other day, we had the president say that we're going to win this war. He forgot that we've won the war, we're only trying to win the peace. The Democrats, on the other hand, they're listening to the electorate. They can see that people are tired of the war, so they are taking advantage of that, of the feelings and the emotions of the people, and they're like, we're going to withdraw immediately. I think it was Barack who said a brigade a month, and Hillary says we'll redeploy immediately. But as you know, when the rubber hits the road and whoever comes into power come January 2009, it will be a totally different ball game. I do not want, if the Democrats come to office, for them to go through what Bill Clinton went through over the issue of Somalia. You know, so it's important that the best way to resolve this issue is to let the Iraqi people vote. No one can accuse us of surrender if they tell us to leave. It will neutralize the statements like surrender, we're going to be there for 100 years, all that will be neutralized completely. It will prevent our country from being further divided over this particular issue, and none of the presidential candidates will be able to use this as a wedge issue, which will do nothing but polarize our country. And this is where we are right now. A house divided on its own cannot stand. When America is in one accord and in unity, there's nothing we cannot accomplish. And I believe that if we can focus on the things that brings us together, we will have the strength and the fortitude to take on the things that divide us. We need to champion common agendas. And I believe that this is something that everybody can embrace. Nobody's against democracy. Nobody's against election. Obviously, it's going to take a year to hold this election. During that time, both the leaders in Iraq and even in America can begin to think about things they can do in between during this period. We can get the United Nations, which has received a lot of criticism in America, to help in the election. One thing that they're very good at is holding elections. With a few exceptions, they've done a pretty good job at holding elections. And we can get them involved. And I believe that this will go a long way in restoring the image and the credibility of the United States of America. And this is why I
have to tell you. I have to tell you, this is probably one of the most humane and wonderful and aligned plans I've ever heard. But let me ask you something, Peter.
Please.
Here in the United States, we don't even have that. And we are considered one of the freest democracies on the face of the planet. We don't have that. Before we attempt to produce this in Iraq, which I am all for, because after all, what have we done but very kindly, as I said earlier, bombed Iraq into another dimension. But how can we produce the same kind of mentality here in the United States in such a divided and polarized situation as it stands today?
Well, you know, it was Winston Churchill that said that the United States system, he alluded, I cannot recall the exact words, that with the exception of all others, American has the worst system with the exception of all others. In other words, we have the best. And our democracy has survived over 200 years. This is the longest surviving democracy in the world. And it has thrived because, at the end of the day, the people have always had a say in the decision-making process of their government. It is when the people have thrived.
Is that really true today, Peter? Do you really believe that that's true today?
Yeah, that's why I'm coming to that. It's when the people that are deprived in making decisions, key decisions that affect not just the vitality but as well as the future direction of our country, and that we begin to see the strength of the country and beginning to slip away. And over the last 8 years, there's been some big questions in the hearts of millions of Americans as to the direction of our country, evidenced by the unpopularity of the president. And I believe that we have made some mistakes, and I prefer to call it mistakes. And there's still an opportunity to turn things around. One of the greatest things about our country is that every 4 years we get to elect a new president or re-elect the incumbent. And it's usually the will of the people that speaks. And I believe that everybody's looking for change, as Obama talked about. However, I would like to remind you that change is like a coin. There are two sides of a coin. It could be change for the worse and change for the better. 8 years ago, this president promised us change, and look at the change we've had. I think what is left right now is nothing but change in the pockets of some of us. So,
yes, for sure. Now, Peter, what is your assessment of the state of affairs in Congress and the Senate in regards to this kind of divisiveness that really has just unbelievably polarized our nation?
The state of the affairs is born out of the fact that each political party thinks that they have all the answers. And I believe that perfection is not found in either political parties because it's made up of people like you and I. We need to, as I mentioned earlier on, or alluded, champion common agendas. And that as we work on common agendas, we will have the necessary strength to take on the things that divide us. We can recognize our differences and embrace our similarities. We also have a lot of wedge issues that have come into this country that has polarized our nation's political discussion. And if you're not on one side, then the other side hates you. And the hate politics is one of the most dangerous things that is afflicting this country. And we need to avoid that. There's also a spirit of deception. And what that means, I mentioned it in my website why I'm running for Congress. We need to abandon what we call the smokescreen agendas that masquerade themselves like real solutions, but all they do is undermine the quality of life of the American people. So we are a great nation made of great people, but when we do not put our egos where they belong and we bring them into our political discussions, we can bring harm to the nation's vitality and to the nation's economy, to our national security, to everything. And so the state of affairs in Congress is reflective in the polls. Congress has a very, very poor showing in the polls, and the president also has a very poor showing. So the government in America has abandoned the will of the people, and we're a government of the people, for the people, by the people. And so my suggestion is that we need to make sure that every decision that is made in the corridors of power in Washington must be predicated on righteousness and justice. We must ask whether it is right and whether it is just. Every legislative decision that becomes before a legislature, we must ask how is it going to affect the people that sent them there in the first place. We must understand that leadership is about servitude, that the greatest among them shall be a servant first. We must tie decisions made in Washington to the quality of life of people. When you lift up the American people, you lift up America.
Wow, that is like, I'm sitting here listening to you and I'm thinking, I'm going to vote for you. I love this. I really do. I have to tell you, Peter, I'm very impressed by what you're saying here. Let me ask you, this summer I'm involved with a political symposium, Peter, in a particular organization that I have been affiliated with for many years. And part of our symposium, the second day of the symposium, is dedicated to mass media and its power in the electoral process. Do you find it difficult that no matter what you say, there is a media that will hang on every word and, you know, in fact, will probably come back to haunt you one day? Does that kind of pressure sometimes overshadow the heartfelt sincerity of the path that you've taken?
Words are powerful. Rome, Romanism, Rebellion gave the elections to Grover Cleveland when he was running for president. Words can break, make you. They can empower people. They can unleash potential in people's hearts and minds. They can cause a war. They can cause a quarrel. They can lead to a divorce. So everybody has to temper their words with wisdom and discernment. One has to be careful what they say because it can be misconstrued by your opponents. And so I'm very, very careful. I want to make sure that no one questions my patriotism to this great country. I want them to know that I'm proud to be an American. But part of the pride of being an American is to speak freely, to express one's opinion without fear or intimidation. And once we begin to trample on those civil liberties, then we become just like any other nation. Thank God we have not yet got there. But we can see that right now, because of national security issues, there are certain things and certain powers have been given to our security infrastructure that, for me, is quite troubling. I believe that we can protect our country at the same time protect civil liberties. And so one has to be careful what they say publicly. For me, it's easy. I love this country. This has become my home for 24 years. And I've seen the greatness of America. I know its potential. And I believe that its best days are yet to come. But yet some eerie, troubling signs, many worrying concerns about our country, the direction of our nation, that we have become an economic colony of China, that our reserves are in the red, and that we lower interest rates to spur the economy, we give tax breaks and the money spent on goods that are made in China, that we are losing our economic edge as a super economic power, that we have guided missiles but misguided policies. All these things are concerns to me, broken homes and broken families. These are issues that are dear to my heart, and I love this country. I pray for it every day. But again, to change things in this country is going to bring about a massive mindset change. You know, Barack Obama talked about the smallness of politics and the need to change the mindset that led us into the war in the first place. We have to renew our minds so that we're no longer conformed to the patterns of this old order, but we're able to test and approve brilliant issues that affect everyone. We need to abandon narrow-minded parochial politics, become more altruistic in our thinking. I know America believes in individual freedom, and I champion individual freedom, but even though we believe in individual freedom, there's a limited role that government can play in the lives of people. We need to make sure that our bridges are strong and ready, that they don't fall down. When the bridge fell down in Minneapolis, our senator, Amy Klobuchar, she said, bridges don't fall down in America. And this is true. Broken down infrastructure, that is not a good thing at all for the number one nation in the world.
Do you think that was a metaphor of some sort for our country today?
I don't know, but it's the truth.
Absolutely. You know, as we're speaking here about these kinds of things, about rising to a higher standard of citizenry in this country, how do you feel about the statements made by Reverend Jeremiah Wright and how it has affected adversely the Obama campaign, which has been a very poignant and important, I believe, step down as to a higher order of calling?
For Barack Obama? Well, first and foremost, I have my highest respect and veneration for Barack Obama. I think he's an honorable man. I think his heart is in the right place. And I think that he's pursuing a unique thing in our country. He's more concerned about the unity of the country, and he has seen the potential of America when we can abandon what he calls the smallness of politics that are so typical in Washington these days. On the other hand, Barack, just like his minister or pastor, is human. Both of them are not perfect. Like me and you, we make mistakes. Sometimes we say things we should not say, and sometimes we say things that may be right but misconstrued, and sometimes we say things that are wrong and not well thought of. Now, the situation with the minister, he's a pastor, and he made statements that may have sounded inflammatory or may have put some concerns in people's heart. But, and how does that reflect that is part of Obama's lifestyle, or that's the way he conducts himself? And the argument was that he goes to that church, and he never cautioned his minister about what he said. To be honest and sincere with you, I don't think it's for any one of us to judge. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. There's no perfect person, and we can choose to over-glamorize and embellish and make hay and a big light of this incident. But to be honest and sincere with you, my take on it is that it's the minister today, tomorrow to be somebody else. How many times has President Bush said something he shouldn't have said? Does that mean that
every time he opens his mouth, if you ask me?
I wouldn't go that far.
I know that.
But does that mean that because he made something bad, therefore Laura Bush, who I like, is a bad woman? Because that's her husband?
No.
So
no.
Where are we going to when we begin to try to pin Obama on the things that his minister said? For crying out loud, I mean, he can't tell the minister what to say. He's a minister, you know. And Obama, so I believe that this thing has been overplayed. And I think that all of us need to take a back seat and take a deep breath and have mercy and compassion. I think we can pray for the minister and we can try and look at Obama on who he is based on his merits and his character and not on the credentials of another person. And so we have
to be
very
careful. By the way, when are you going to be running for president? Ladies and gentlemen, we have with us this evening on the People Speak radio show, Peter Adishogo. He is running for, he's an independent, running for Congress in Minnesota. If
Correction. I'm a Democrat. I am a Democrat. I'm a DFL candidate running for Congress.
I apologize. I stand corrected. A Democrat running for Congress in Minnesota. Thank you very much. And for those, for correcting me, and for those of you that would like to call in and speak to him, you can call on our toll-free lines, 877-489-6350, or toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494. Feel free to call in. It is really, I have to admit that it takes a lot to impress me anymore in our political arena, Peter, and you have certainly impressed me. And I'm not just saying this. I have to tell you that I myself, like other Americans in this country today, are disappointed. We are frustrated. We feel that our voices are being neglected. And that's why I asked you this this question about, you know, here we are discussing this people-based society in Iraq, and we have lost that very essence in that, or a lot of people believe that we have lost that. Some of the positions that you are talking about are just, I believe, a cut above the average congressman, and I would have absolutely no problems seeing you in Congress. Peter, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions as to, I know some of your positions and some of your stances. You're calling, first of all, one of the things that's very important for a lot of Americans today is the quality of care and protection for our American soldiers and changes in our security policies. What are these changes that you would like to see implemented, and what would help us to have a renewed confidence that you or any member of Congress can actually affect a positive change in these areas?
Well, first of all, if you look at my website on national security, which I wrote that piece in its entirety, I stated that the key to national security is to replace the current spirit of fear, which has sometimes been used for political purposes, with a spirit of boldness and innovation, that we can begin by fully first implementing the 911 report, which was drawn up by a bipartisan group led by Thomas Kean, former governor and Congressman Lee Hamilton. If a terrorist should successfully attack us today, the chances are it will be because we failed to fully incorporate the critical recommendations of the 911 report. We must act quickly and responsibly in that area. We must practice drill sessions with the fire, the police, and medical emergencies to ensure coordinated and shared communications have been tested for worst-case scenarios and eliminated all shortcomings. And then we need to look at our Coast Guard, because a lot of shipping comes through our ports. And I believe that we have a very porous port down there. We need to use the U.S. Coast Guard to maintain maritime domain awareness, pushing our borders out across the seaports, checking cargoes before they even come into America, before they even arrive at our ports. We need to be greater coordination among the intelligence agencies. You know, you have the Central Intelligence Agency, you have the Defense Intelligence Agency, you have State Department has the Intelligence Agency, you have the Naval Intelligence Agency, you have the Air Force Intelligence Agency, Army Intelligence, Military Intelligence, and then we need to make sure that there's a greater coordination among these intelligence agency that is a single channel in terms of emergency on who to, where to go, so that there's a rapid response. Equally important, the executive branch must achieve all these things without abusing the rights of Americans, which is very, very important for all of us. And we have seen that when we give the executive branch extra judicial power to carry out the necessary work that needs to be done, like spying on our adversaries, both at home and abroad, they sometimes have abused that. And there's still some investigation in Congress right now to see whether this current White House overextended themselves when it came to the tapping of phones of Americans who were calling abroad. I can understand the need to protect the territorial integrity of the United States of America, and I am for it. And I am for every arsenal and every tool and every technology to be deployed to defend this great country, to protect our airspace, to protect our land, to protect our seaports, to protect our homeland. But we can achieve these things without trampling on the civil liberties of America. There needs to be a strategic balance. I am troubled when senior citizens' names are on the terrorist list and they're delayed at the airport, and because a mistake or a glitch had happened to the system. That is wrong. That needs to change. And I believe that the best way to enhance our security is to focus on 21st century technologies. That means bringing people into the country that speak multiple languages, that love America, that we can be used as an intelligence arm to decode messages coming from adversaries. We must develop a new defense strategy to reflect the changing geopolitical landscape and the rise of new emerging powers. Our war colleges must go beyond studying past wars and current conflicts to understanding the thinking and unpredictable ways of the new rising powers in the world. Equal emphasis must be placed on both modern warfare and first-class diplomacy. We must learn that some wars are unnecessary, and also that it's not always in our strategic interest for the United States to pursue war. This is the truth about our country. And the world
well, I have to tell you, we do have a caller on line 3 from Hamilton, Canada. And before we take Gay from Hamilton, Canada on line 3, I have to tell you that I have asked this question of I don't know how many candidates that have come on our show and appeared on our show. And you, sir, are the first one that has ever actually had anything to say. I salute you, sir. Even our board direct operator is telling me, how can we vote for him? this is just amazing. I'm really blown away by you, Peter. I think you're just a magnificent expression of what a true diplomat. And I think that's something that's missing in our government today. We no longer have diplomats. We have multinational buyouts. That's all we have. Gay from Hamilton, Canada, on line 3, do you have a question for Peter Adishogi?
Yes, first of all, I'd like to say he has been saying a lot of things that I've been wanting to hear for a long time. But my question to Peter is, if you get into office this time, what would you do to encourage universal health care, not just for the Minnesotans, but for the rest of the people of the United States? I feel healthcare is very important, and it should be universal for everybody so that 47 million people are not without it. Thank you.
Well, I thank that person that spoke on the phone. I wish I had your name to call them by name and tell them thank you. The kind of person that uses a first name basis. But anyways, it's a very good question. It's a valid question. It's a big question in the elections, both at the presidential level and everywhere. They are not just 47 million uninsured Americans. They are a similar number of Americans that are underinsured. In other words, they have insurance, but it does not go far enough, and it leaves a huge out-of-pocket expense that they have to deal with. In fact, I believe that the third leading cause of bankruptcy in America is people who have had expensive surgeries, and the out-of-pocket expense is so high to pay for it, and so they go bankrupt in the greatest nation in the world. There are some good things about the American medical system. We are number one when it comes to acute cure, invasive chest surgery. The new technologies that is deployed constantly to spend less time in the operating room and recovering time much quicker. The uses of laser technology to deal with some peculiar surgeries like prostate cancer, zapping a lymph node or whatever it is, a little tumor of cancer in different parts of the body. However, the biggest issue with universal healthcare is that there's a powerful group of people in this nation that have used propaganda and negative statements and deception, outright deception, to literally convince a significant number of the citizens of this country that universal healthcare is the wrong way to go. It's on quote unquote socialized medicine, Canadian style, etc. They look at the things that are not the best in Canadian system, and they emphasize on that, and they never mention the things that are good in the Canadian system. And so that's one group. Then there's the second group of people who believe that we need universal health care, but they are torn between a single-payer system, which is the Canadian style, or a system that involves a partnership between the government, the employer, as well as the individual contribution. And that battle is being waged on even to this very day. Healthcare occupies a significant amount of our GDP of this nation. It's one of the biggest bleeding wounds that we are dealing with. And unless it's resolved, it can literally bankrupt the entire United States of America. And so I believe in universal coverage that has the following things. Greater emphasis on preventative medicine versus acute cure. Because I believe that 80% of the cost of major healthcare costs right now is borne by 20% of the chronic diseases. So, and many of these chronic diseases like diabetes, you know, heart attack, stroke, you know, all these things can be resolved in most cases, and I know some are hereditary, but in most cases, if we eat right and take care of our bodies. And so I promote individual freedom, and we'll literally give a tax break to up to $200 to every American citizen that goes to a gym facility of their choice to work out so that we can compete with the Chinese and the Canadians.
Yeah,
I also want to bring technology in the dispensing of drugs. One of the leading causes of death in the hospitals in America is misdiagnosed prescriptions, wrong prescriptions, and so we need to make sure that that is corrected, and we can use technology to correct that, to make sure that when we're giving prescription to a particular patient, the name of the doctor is on it, the name of the patient is on it, the purpose of the prescription is on it, so that their mistakes are avoided, and people don't die just because they go to a hospital to get treated. This is a country where people have actually died on the hospital floor because of ignorance and apathy. We saw that on CNN several months ago.
A guest of ours, Peter from Massachusetts, Sue from Massachusetts, is asking, what is your connection with pharmaceutical companies?
I have no direct connection with pharmaceutical companies. I may have a relative that that works with one of them, but I have no connections whatsoever. I haven't received any contribution from any pharmaceutical companies. I believe that American pharmacists are one of the most innovative in the world, and in most cases they are a source for good and a force for good. But I believe that they can also contribute in extensively in helping to lower the cost of healthcare overall. For example, the biggest entitlement ever created in the history of America was the prescription drug plan that President Bush introduced for our senior citizens. I'm glad that our senior citizens have a prescription drug plan, but the problem we have there is that they did not negotiate with the pharmaceutical industries like the government is supposed to do. Anytime you want to get a contract from the government, whether it's the military or the social security system, they negotiate with vendors for the best price. They didn't do that with the pharmaceuticals. And so this may end up costing us over $8 trillion in the long run, and that is dangerous.
Very interesting. Mike from California, Who are you voting for president and why?
You know, it's a very good question. I'm a Democrat, so I'm inclined to look at the Democratic candidates first before I look at the Republicans second, which means I'm an open-minded person. And I have some friends that are for Barack Obama, and I have some friends that are for Hillary Clinton. As for me, I'm for my friends.
Exactly. Very statesman of you, very diplomatic, and again, I repeat, that is an interesting... Kitty from Australia asks in our email, what is your definition of health care?
You know, it's a very important question. My definition of health care is that when someone is healthy and they are a citizen of this country, they each contribute to a healthy economy. My definition of healthcare is for every citizen of this country who is sick to be able to go to a nearby clinic and get treated, and when they're treated, they don't go bankrupt from their treatment. They can see a doctor of their choice, and they can get the right prescription for their situation. And that the person who ministers the healthcare to them is not an insurance bureaucrat, but the doctor. Right now in America, insurance companies tell doctors what kind of treatment you and I should get. How can the people that did not go to medical school decide what kind of care that we should get? Something's fundamentally wrong.
Well, I'll tell you, you have had some incredible answers. I think you're one of the first candidates that I've listened to in a long time that hasn't given the standard obligatory style of responses, it's really been a pleasure having you on here this evening. Peter, how does it look for you? Honestly, in your opinion, how do you feel about how your campaign is progressing?
My campaign is more like an insurgency campaign right now. I'm in the fight for the nomination for my party with another gentleman. We're both fighting to be the flag bearer of the party as far as this congressional district goes. And I have my highest respect and for my opponent. I just believe that I bring vision and a tenacious commitment to pursue the things that are predicated on righteousness and justice. And I have sworn to always tie every quality decision I make, should I become the congressman, to the quality of life of people. And I'm not a cookie-cutter Democrat. I consider myself an iconoclastic. If there are things that are Republican, that are righteous, I will embrace them, and I will defend them. As I said, I do not believe we have all the answers. And so right now in this race, it's hard to... I'm gaining momentum, the big mo. The momentum is on my side. However... by May 3rd, the vote will be made by the party leaders on who they want to represent the district. And I'm hoping and praying that I am the candidate based on what they have observed and because of the transparency of my campaign and the fact that I have a campaign that reaches beyond the party base to the other side of the political aisle, because that district is fairly a little bit conservative. The Republican incumbent has been there for 6 years. We've put powerful, famous people against him, and they've lost. And I believe what has been missing is that they've tended to campaign against him rather than for something. And my campaign is for a better America. If you look at my website, there's nothing that I mention about my opponent. And because as far as I'm concerned, it's not about him. The election is not about him, nor is it about me. It's about the people in my district. It's about taking their voice into the corridors of power in Washington and bringing about bold fundamental change. This is what this campaign is about. So I need a lot of media attention to propel my message. Unfortunately, sincerely, I do not have the media coverage that I wish I had, and I'm hoping that my Iraqi Solution, which is on YouTube, www.iraqisolution.com, will spur an excitement, not just in the country but in the world. And I'm asking people who are listening to this to write the major newspapers and editors, including CNN, NPR, National Public Radio, to take a look at the Iraqi solution. I hear Anderson Cooper on CNN talking about Iraq, and none of them seem to talk about the solution. They mention the problem, and all we hear about is redeployment and be there for 100 years, and both of these issues are non-starters. And the real
well, I have to tell
proposed.
You, I am wholeheartedly behind your position. I agree with you. I think you have just been an important asset to our show. Thank you for being with us tonight, Peter. Yes. I'm sorry we got a late start. I would have liked to have had another hour with you. I think this has just been magnificent. Our guest tomorrow night at 8 o'clock Eastern with our host David Swanson is author and professor Mark Crispin Miller. He's a professor of media studies at New York University and the author of the book, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Elections. And I'll be back with you next week on Tuesday night at 8 o'clock Eastern with our guest, Michael Parenti, author of Democracy for a Few. I appreciate you being with us. Good luck with your campaign, Mr. Adishoki. Congratulations. You have been a remarkable guest on our show. Thank you very much and have a wonderful evening.
To donate some money to the campaign. And if there are two numbers...
You heard it, guys. Anybody that's out in Minnesota, come on, donate. Let's get out there.
Nationwide. They can donate nationwide. Nationwide.
Nationwide.
And
if there
are two numbers floating in their head, they should use the big one.
And we have been promoting your website, and you can go to www.thepeoplespeakradio.net, and you can find out more information. Please join us in an effort to get a better Congress. Thank you, and good night, everyone.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Goodbye.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the sea, by the relief of death, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.
Hi, this is Robert Lee Kemp, the host of the Mr. Destiny radio show here on bbsradio.com. Tune in Monday nights on the late night section at 7:30 Pacific and 10:30 Eastern. I want to invite you to come and listen in or participate in our lively and informative shows. Would you like to know something about your special destiny? How about your personal relationships or your finances? Are you thinking of moving but not sure when or if you should? Did you just meet somebody and want to know whether or not you are compatible? Would you like to know when you will meet somebody new or have more business success? Or would you like some help understanding your life and yourself? If you answered yes to any of these questions, I may have some answers for you. Tell me your birthday and I can reveal your secrets, maybe even secrets that you don't even know. The system I use is described in my two books, Cards of Your Destiny and Love Cards, available in all major bookstores. Your birthday is the key to your birth card, and that card tells me everything about you. I invite you to come and learn more. I hope to see you then.
past was complicated.